Hello and welcome back to The Fall of the Roman Empire. It's Nick Holmes and this is episode 65, called Not With a Bang, But a Whimper. In the last episode, we heard how the huge Roman fleet sent to recover Carthage in 468 was destroyed by the Vandals in a fiery haze. The wily Gaiseric, king of the Vandals, had won by far his greatest victory. And just 8 years later, in 476, the Western Empire would be officially proclaimed dead. So, how and why did that happen? Let's start with Ricimer. When the Eastern Emperor Leo made Anthemius Western Emperor, it looked as if Ricimer's time was up. But Leo didn't get rid of him. Bad mistake. He'd have been better off without him, since Ricimer did his best to undermine the great expedition against Carthage by preventing the Western Roman fleet from joining the Eastern Armada. Then, as soon as news of the Vandal victory reached Italy, he almost certainly instigated the assassination of his rival and co-patrician, the general Marcellinus, who'd driven the Vandals out of Sicily. With Leo firmly on the back foot after his disastrous defeat, Ricimer now just had to get rid of Anthemius to reinstate himself as the virtual king of Italy. Anthemius was aware of this, and he seems to have thought Ricimer tried to kill him through sorcery when he became ill. According to one source in 470, quote, Anthemius, the emperor of the West, fell into a serious sickness by sorcery and punished many men involved in this crime, especially one named Romanus, who held the post of master of the office and was enrolled among the patricians, being a very close friend of Ricimer, end quote. Anthemius had Romanus executed. Whether Ricimer really had tried to kill him through sorcery or more likely poison, we'll never know. But the execution of one of his main supporters provoked an outright war between the two of them. Ricimer gathered his Italian army, said to be 6,000 strong, and almost certainly comprising Germanic mercenaries rather than the remnants of the Italian legions, and he advanced to meet Anthemius in battle near Milan. Meanwhile, in Constantinople, the Eastern Emperor Leo watched Anthemius's plight with great concern, but there was nothing he could do since he was himself embroiled in his own power struggle with his version of Ricimer, the German general Aspar. In 470, this also reached boiling point, and with the help of his Isaurian general Zeno, he had both Aspar and his son Ardabur executed. Although Leo had re-established his authority, he still couldn't spare troops for Anthemius, so he did the next best thing. He announced the marriage in 471 between Anthemius's son Marcian and his daughter Leontia. It worked. Ricimer was sufficiently worried about a backlash from the east if he killed Anthemius to come to terms with him. Using Epiphanius, the bishop of Pavia, as their go-between, both men agreed to work together. However, the Roman chronicler Ennodius has left us with a record of their meeting, which appears far from amicable. They traded insults, Anthemius telling Ricimer he was a skin-clad Goth, while Ricimer said Anthemius couldn't control his temper. But while Ricimer and Anthemius bickered with each other, the real story lay elsewhere. The many Germanic tribes in possession of the great majority of the Western Empire's territory, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, Franks, Suevi, and of course the Vandals, knew that the defeat of the Eastern Armada in 468 marked a point of no return for the Western Empire. But perhaps surprisingly, it was not the Vandals who rushed to exploit the opportunity they'd created. Instead, the most intent on destroying what remained of Western Roman authority was Euric, king of the Visigoths. He was the younger brother of Theodoric II, who turned against him and murdered him in 465. Ruthlessly ambitious, he saw that the civil war between Ricimer and Anthemius was an opportunity. As Jordanes recounted, quote, becoming aware of the frequent changes of Roman emperor, Euric, king of the Visigoths, took the initiative to seize the Gallic provinces on his own authority, end quote. First, he tried to seize the north of Gaul. In 469, he defeated the pro-Roman Bretons, led by King Riothamus. He took control of Tours and Bourges, and Riothamus fled to find sanctuary with the Burgundians. But Euric's progress in the north was halted by the still powerful Roman enclave around Soissons, that fragment of the old empire that historians call the Kingdom of Soissons, and which was ruled by Aegidius's son, Syagrius. So he turned his army south and marched on Arles, the Roman capital of southern Gaul. His approach coincided with the rapprochement between Anthemius and Ricimer. It prompted Anthemius to gather an army to meet the Visigoths in battle. Ricimer was still keen to placate the Eastern Emperor Leo and may even have contributed some of his own troops. The Roman army assembled in northern Italy in 471 under the command of Anthemius's son, Anthemiolus. As it crossed the Alps, it would be the last time that a Western Roman army would go into battle to save the empire. Euric led the Visigothic army across the river Rhone to meet it. At an unknown place, somewhere north of the Alps, the two sides met. The result was a crushing Roman defeat. Anthemiolus and all his senior officers and most of his troops were killed. Euric was now the effective master of southern Gaul, although the Roman enclave in the north would hold out for several years after the official end of the Western Empire. In 2 years' time, Euric would take Arles and Marseille and officially end Roman control of Provence. Now, you might have expected this catastrophic defeat to unite Anthemius and Ricimer against their common enemy. But no, in fact, the opposite happened. Seeing Anthemius's position gravely weakened, Ricimer finished him off. He gathered his German mercenaries and called on his nephew, Gundobad, the son of Gundioc, king of the Burgundians, who he recently made Magister Militum in Gaul, to join him. With a formidable army, he marched from Milan to Rome, where Anthemius manned the Aurelian walls surrounding the city with what troops he had. Meanwhile, Anthemius sent messengers to Gaul to one of the few survivors of the disastrous defeat there, a man named Bilimer, commanding him to rush to Rome with what remained of the army that had been so badly defeated by the Visigoths. In March 472, Ricimer laid siege to Rome, but with no success. Anthemius had just enough troops to keep him at bay. The city was too strongly held for him to break through the Aurelian walls. Then a strange event occurred. The Emperor Leo had, as usual, been watching events in the West with growing distaste. But after the catastrophe of 468, he still had no spare troops to send to Anthemius. As mentioned the previous time, he'd resorted to marrying Anthemius's son to his own daughter as a statement of support for Anthemius. Now he tried a different tactic. He sent an embassy from Constantinople to Rome to negotiate a settlement between Anthemius and Ricimer. And this was led by Olybrius, Placidia's husband, who was Gaiseric's candidate to be Emperor of the West. What followed has long confused historians because our main source for this event, Malalas, says that bizarrely, Leo's scheme was for Anthemius to murder both Ricimer and Olybrius while pretending to make peace. If true, it stands as one of the most extraordinary deceits in all of Roman history. I'll quote Malalas in some detail since it is so strange. First, Malalas said, quote, Leo sent to Rome Olybrius, a Roman patrician, so that as a representative of the Roman Senate, he might quell the hostilities that existed between Anthemius and his son-in-law Ricimer, end quote. But he continued, quote, the Emperor Leo, however, suspected that Olybrius favoured Gaiseric and would secretly take his side. He therefore feared, for his own sake, lest Olybrius, who had a tie of marriage with Gaiseric, would betray Constantinople to Gaiseric if Gaiseric declared war upon him. Therefore, Leo gave a message to Anthemius, saying, you must kill your son-in-law Ricimer, lest there be anyone who might betray you. Moreover, I have also sent the patrician Olybrius to you. I wish you to kill him so that you might reign, ruling rather than serving others. End quote. Leo was then apparently foolish enough to entrust this outrageous letter to the hands of a messenger who was intercepted outside Rome by Ricimer, and the contents of the letter revealed. This suited Ricimer perfectly. He showed the letter to Olybrius, who was horrified and more than willing to side with Ricimer. In short, he agreed to become Ricimer's man. In April or early May 472, our records don't make the exact date clear, Ricimer proclaimed Olybrius Emperor of the West. So what can we make of this bizarre incident? Some historians have suggested that Ricimer made the whole thing up, and they may well be right, given that it suited him so well. But my sense is that the incident could be true for two reasons. The first is that Leo had recently had the Gothic general Aspar executed and might have been worried that his supporters could back Olybrius, who in fact had a stronger claim on the purple than Leo because of his marriage to Placidia. Therefore, sending Olybrius to Italy and even arranging for his execution wasn't stupid. What about the unwise decision to send a letter that Ricimer could intercept? Well, the letter was sent to Rome, and it's quite possible it was sent before Leo heard Ricimer was besieging the city. Therefore, its interception could have been truly a mistake. Whatever Leo's true motives, his incompetent handling of the situation meant the die was cast for Anthemius. Without Eastern support and now faced by a rival emperor with a cause, his troops started to desert to Ricimer. Ricimer seized his opportunity and launched an attack, pushing his way into the city. Despite Bilimer's arrival with the troops from Gaul, Anthemius was defeated and Bilimer was killed. Anthemius fled to a church, either St. Peter's or Santa Maria in Trastevere, where the Burgundian prince Gundobad found him disguised as a beggar. On the 11th of July 472, he beheaded him. Ricimer's dislike of him was so intense that he wouldn't give him a proper burial. And it wasn't just Anthemius that was treated brutally. The city of Rome now paid the price for this civil war. Filled with Burgundians and Ricimer's German mercenaries, they sacked the city so thoroughly that Pope Gelasius later said that it should be called the Third Sack of Rome, and it was far worse than Alaric's sack in 410. We can only imagine what they left of the once proud capital of the Roman Empire. The Western Empire was now truly at its last gasp. Abandoned by the Eastern Empire, it only had 4 years to go. But the story still has a few twists and turns. The first surprise was with Ricimer. Only about a month after Anthemius was executed, the virtual king of Italy keeled over dead. No, he wasn't killed in a bloodthirsty palace coup such as he himself had perpetrated on so many others. Ricimer died of natural causes on the 18th of August 472. The historical record says that he died after, quote, vomiting much blood. The academic verdict is he suffered some sort of hemorrhage. This meant the man in charge of Italy was now the Emperor Olybrius. This was, of course, a cause for celebration in faraway Carthage, where Gaiseric, king of the Vandals, had at last achieved his dream. His daughter-in-law's brother-in-law was now Emperor of the West. The time seemed ripe for a second Vandal trip to Rome. Who knows, perhaps Gaiseric would even move into the crumbling imperial palace on the Palatine Hill in Rome. But Gaiseric's smile quickly vanished from his face when he learned that only a few months into his reign, in either October or November 472, Olybrius dropped down dead. There was no sign of foul play. The cause of death stated in our sources was dropsy, which today we would call edema, probably because of heart failure. The leaders of the Western Empire were dropping like flies as fast as the Western Empire itself was racing towards its own demise. Into the breach strode Ricimer's nephew and right-hand man, who'd helped him depose Anthemius, Gundobad, prince of the Burgundians. On the 3rd of March 473, he proclaimed a high-ranking officer, the count of the domestics, a man named Glycerius, as the next emperor. But by this time, did anyone really care who was Western emperor? No one could claim legitimacy. The only convincing qualification was nomination for the job by the Eastern Emperor. But wait a moment, yes, we have a nominee. And that was Julius Nepos, nephew and successor to Marcellinus, the ruler of Dalmatia, who'd been murdered, as you recall, probably on Ricimer's instructions, back in 468. He was Leo's nephew, and although Leo died in that same year and was succeeded by the seven-year-old Leo II, real power lay with the Azorian general Zeno. Now Zeno backed Julius Nepos. At the same time, Gundobad, the new virtual king of Italy, lost interest in the whole charade of who was the Western emperor. When his father Gundioc died, he returned to Gaul to stake his claim to the Burgundian throne. This opened the door for Julius Nepos, who landed at Ostia in July 474, marched on Rome and deposed Glycerius, who surrendered without a fight. Nepos was generous enough to give him a position as the Bishop of Salona in Dalmatia, and well known to Roman historians because of its close proximity to Diocletian's palace in Split, the remains of which are still spectacular today. We're nearly at the end of the Western Empire, but Julius Nepos offered it one last throw of the dice. But that dice was loaded. Nepos was in an impossible situation. If the Eastern Emperor Leo's Great Armada had failed to restore the Western Empire, there was simply no way that he could snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. In Gaul, Nepos's general Edicius was defeated by the Visigoths. In Italy, Nepos couldn't control his German mercenaries, who backed their own commander, Orestes. Orestes, if you recall from episode 54, had accompanied the Roman chronicler Priscus to have dinner with Attila all the way back in 449. Born in Pannonia, when this region beside the Danube had been overrun by Attila, he'd learned the Hunnic language and become one of Attila's most trusted secretaries and ambassadors. After the breakup of Attila's empire, he'd found his way back to the Western court and resumed his remarkable career as the chief general of the German mercenaries and effective heir to Ricimer. Orestes now turned against Nepos, who in August 475 fled Ravenna and returned to Dalmatia. Orestes made his own son, Romulus, Western Emperor on the 31st of October 475. Because he was only aged somewhere between 10 to 15 years old, he was nicknamed Augustulus, the Little Augustus. Historians have never understood why Orestes made his son emperor rather than taking the title himself. Perhaps he felt his association with Attila was inappropriate. We'll never know for sure. But the truth was, it really didn't matter whether it was Orestes or his son who claimed the throne, because neither of them was going to last long. The problem was that Orestes couldn't control the German mercenaries. Our sources are limited, but the Germans wanted a significant settlement of land, perhaps one-third of the land owned by the Roman senators. Orestes resisted for reasons that aren't clear. Perhaps he wanted to keep the backing of the Senate, who were opposed to giving the Germans more power. Whatever really happened, he misjudged the situation badly, for the Germans proclaimed his deputy, Odoacer, king of Italy, and marched to depose Orestes, who gathered a small force, perhaps what we can call the last Italian legion. But it didn't replicate the heroic feats of the ancient Romans. At Piacenza on the 28th of August 476, Odoacer defeated Orestes and executed him. He advanced on Ravenna, where he executed Orestes's brother Paul, but spared the young Romulus out of pity, it seems. One main source says he persuaded Romulus to abdicate with the Senate's agreement and sent a letter to the Eastern Roman Emperor Zeno saying, quote, "They, i.e. the Senate, had chosen Odoacer, a man of military and political experience, to safeguard their own affairs, and that Zeno should confer upon him the rank of patrician and entrust him with the government of Italy," end quote. Zeno had no wish to interfere with the affairs of the West. He had enough problems in the East. So he reluctantly complied with the Senate's request and recognised Odoacer as patrician and governor of Italy, although in his reply he still insisted that Julius Nepos should be recognised as Western emperor. But no one cared about Julius Nepos. Although he would live until 480, Odoacer took no notice of him. Instead, in most historians' eyes, he brought the Western Empire to an end by sending the imperial vestments, including, of course, the diadem and purple cloak, to Constantinople, explicitly stating he didn't want them back. There's a footnote to all of this that might have amused Attila the Hun. For not only was Orestes formerly his secretary, as I mentioned, but Odoacer was none other than the son of Adeko, the Hunnic ambassador who, as I recounted in episode 54, the Eastern Romans tried to bribe in their assassination attempt on Attila in 449. So, in its last days, the Western Empire was ruled by the minions of the great Hunnic king. And it fell not with a bang, but a whimper. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And you'll be glad to hear that it's certainly not the end of this podcast. I intend to carry on for a lot more episodes, which will see the Eastern Empire reconquer much of the West, and then itself be largely destroyed by the rise of Islam. And in the next episode, which will be in 2 weeks' time, so on July the 1st, since I'm now finishing my third book in this series, we'll change the subject away from the political narrative to hear more about what life was like for ordinary Romans as the Western Empire collapsed. And in the meantime, please do check out my new book, The Fall of Rome. And if you want a free ebook, please visit my new website at nickholmesauthor.com, where you'll find my first book called The Byzantine World War, about the decline of the Byzantine Empire and the start of the Crusades. And if you like this podcast, I guarantee you'll like the book. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.